And welcome back
to Behind the Crime.
I'm Rebecca Wood.
And I'm Ella Calora.
And this is our 19th episode.
We're almost at 20.
I know.
Today we have a special episode. We're going to talk about the Toolbox Killers.
Yeah. On our Halloween episode, we covered their one case and we said that we were definitely going to go back in and do a whole episode just about them because they killed so many people. So that's what we're doing this episode.
Yeah. So Becky's going to do the background about them, and then I'm going to talk more about the actual victims and what they did, and then their convictions.
With that being said, this is a bit of a more graphic episode for us.
Yeah, so I will say this again while I'm talking about it, but I'm not going to go into a ton of detail about what they did. If you want to know about that, you can go read it on your own time, but I don't feel comfortable saying some of the things
again,
that they did out loud.
We want our podcast to be more of a platform for the victims and the people that are affected by the crimes that we cover, and we don't want it so much to be focusing on the people who did this. Like, we don't want them to get recognition for this necessarily, so it's also just, they did some awful, awful things, like very disgusting. So it's just not,
it's not comfortable to talk about.
And I think it's better for people to read about it on their own as opposed to like hearing about it, because you might not
feel comfortable.
Yeah. It's just more of a comfort thing.
Yeah.
So we just wanted to kind of do a little disclaimer with that. But with that being said, I guess we're going to get into the case. So the Toolbox Killers, if you don't know, obviously they're a very big, very well-known serial killers, but we are going to, you know, kind of treat it as if you might not know anything about them. So the killers are Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris. I'm going to start by going into Lawrence Bittaker's childhood, just because he is the older one and he was the brains of the operation as well. So he was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 27th in 1940. So yeah, he's in Pennsylvania.
I did not know that.
Well, part of it is, I'll get into it in a second, but he was put up for adoption as an infant, and he was adopted by George Bittaker and his wife. I didn't find her first name anywhere. They were only referred to as Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker, so no name for her. So George Bittaker worked at aircraft factories, which caused the family to move around a lot, which is why it's not really super well known that he's from Pennsylvania, because he didn't live there for very long. They moved from PA to Florida to Ohio, and then eventually settled down in California, and that's where Lawrence lived most of his life. So he had a very high IQ. His IQ is 138, which is in the 99th percentile of the IQ test. But despite how intelligent he was, he dropped out of high school at age 17. And by the time he had dropped out at 17, he'd already been arrested several times for just petty crimes. And spent some time in juvie. It was nothing like super serious, but he didn't want to be in school. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of why he dropped out. So after he dropped out, he was pretty shortly after he was arrested and sentenced to 2 years in prison for auto theft, evading arrest, and leaving the scene of a hit and run. So he basically stole a car, hit another car with it, drove away from the scene, and then evaded arrest. But, you know, ended up getting caught, so he was arrested. Only days after finishing that two-year sentence, he was arrested in Louisiana by the FBI for violating the Interstate Motor Vehicle Theft Act. For this arrest, he was sentenced to 18 months, and it was supposed to be served in a federal reformatory in Oklahoma. But he was transferred to a medical center in Missouri because of good behavior. And he claims that he had his first sexual encounter in the hospital, in the medical center, but gave no, like, details as to who it was with other than a female that was there. So it's not really known if it was misconduct from an employee, or it was another patient, or it was, I don't know, a visitor or something. Like, there's no, It's also just, like, weird, but he, like, I don't know, he, like, bragged about it in a way.
Oh.
And, like, just continue, like, considering the context of the crimes that we'll get into later, which does involve a lot of sexual abuse, I felt that this was kind of important to include. But he ended up only serving a third of his sentence and was released. In 1960, he was arrested in Los Angeles for a robbery and was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in state prison. He was then given a psych evaluation, which said that he was paranoid and borderline psychotic, as well as manipulative, and that he had little control over his impulses.
And he still got out later.
He frequently got out for good behavior. There was also another psych eval at some point that classified him as a sociopath as well. For the robbery in L.A., he was released conditionally after only 2 years, but 2 months later was arrested again for a parole violation and suspicion of robbery. So that was, you know, the condition. If there was suspicion, he would go back to jail. So he did. He spent the next 15 years serving time for various crimes, mostly having to do with theft and burglary. One of the last sentences that he... Actually, the last sentence that he had before he met Roy Norris, who is the other toolbox killer, the sentence was for attempted murder, which was over a steak.
Oh.
So he stabbed a grocery store clerk in the parking lot after he attempted to steal a steak from the grocery store. He stuffed the steak down his pants and walked out into the parking lot. The employee followed him out of the store, which was where... Bittaker stabbed him, and he survived because it was attempted murder. So luckily he survived, and Bittaker was arrested. And during this sentence is when he and Roy Norris met.
Okay.
So now I'm going to get into Roy Norris's childhood, and then we'll meet back in the middle of where they met each other. So Roy Norris was born in Greeley, Colorado on February 12th, 1948, so he was 8 years younger than Lawrence Bittaker was. He was born out of wedlock, but his parents married each other to avoid the social stigma of having a child without being married. So they basically had a loveless marriage. Like, they didn't love each other. They didn't want to be married. They didn't want a kid, but they did it anyway just because of the social stigma, especially in the 40s and 50s. So his mother had substance abuse problems, and his father worked in a scrapyard. His mother stayed at home. She didn't work. And Norris had a difficult childhood. He was frequently taken from the house and placed in different foster homes because his parents were repeatedly deemed to be unfit. Norris claims that at times he went hungry, didn't have enough clothing, and was abused by both his father and foster parents. He reportedly suffered a lot of abuse at the hands of his foster parents, as well as sexual abuse in at least one of the foster families that he was placed with. There's not a lot of information about that. Nothing was ever done about it, so to say. They didn't, like, no formal report was made. No one was ever arrested for it, and there's not, like, detail as to what happened or who did it. So at 16, Norris did have a suicide attempt because he made sexual advances to a female relative that he was visiting, and she not only rejected his advances and kicked him out of her house, but she also reported the comments he made to Norris's father. His father then threatened him. So in response to, like, you know, threatened him violently. So in response to his father's threats, he took his dad's car and drove up to the mountains. While he was there, he tried to inject himself with air to cause air embolism. So that was his plan, like, basically just, like, pump air into his veins and die from that.
I've never heard of that before.
I've heard the word, but I've never, like, heard of someone that being their suicide attempt. Yeah. So if he had succeeded, like if he had done it correctly or whatever, he would have died. But his attempt failed, and I don't know if his father knew where he went, but police were there. They picked him up and brought him home. And when he got home, he was basically greeted by his mother saying he wasn't a wanted baby and that they were getting a divorce.
Oh!
Like, good job, mom. That's exactly what you say to your son who just tried to kill himself. Like,
now, I'm not a parent, but
that don't seem right. That just doesn't seem like the correct thing to do.
Well, it's just
for
not.
So many reasons. Like,
okay.
Like, okay. She never should have said he wasn't a wanted baby. Like, he probably would have figured that out one day on his own anyway.
How old is he at this point?
16. Likely he already knew. Also, they shouldn't have said that they were getting divorced that day. Like, they should have, I don't know, given him a couple days to recover, taken him to a psychologist or a hospital.
Well, that's why I was going to say the police picked him up and just brought him home. They didn't take him to the hospital. That seems a little incorrect to me.
I don't know if they thought that, I don't know, it was a weird attempt. Like, it was a not typical method of suicide. So they were like, no, he just wanted attention, or he wasn't really going to do anything, or he wasn't really hurt. He was fine. I don't know. Or there was also just, you know, the idea of, like, men's mental health back then wasn't really a thing. Mm. But so many things went wrong that possibly could have made him not be this evil person that he became. Starting, first of all, with his parents, then second of all, with his foster families, and then third of all, with the police that picked him up after his suicide attempt. So a year later, when he was 17, he joined the Navy, dropped out of school, joined the Navy. He spent most of his time in the service in San Diego, but he did spend 4 months in Vietnam, but he didn't see any combat, so it's not like any of his trauma had to do with PTSD from, like, war or anything like that. In November of 1969, he was arrested for attempted rape after he attacked a woman on a motorcycle. He was released on bail after 3 months, and then shortly after being released, he was arrested again for breaking into a woman's home with the intent to rape her. Luckily, police stopped him before anything physically happened to the woman. She, like, you know, she was physically fine.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that doesn't account for her mental state. And it was breaking and entering, so he likely broke a window or something to get into her home. So he received administrative discharge from the Navy as a result of his crimes, but they gave him, like, an honorable discharge on grounds of psychological problems and severe schizoid personality.
Mm.
Which is interesting considering he was a violent criminal. Like, maybe it shouldn't have been honorable, but whatever. The next May, he was still out on bail, and he almost killed a woman by first bashing her head with a rock and then slamming her head onto a street. She was a student at San Diego State College, so she was very young. She didn't die, but because she didn't die, he was only charged with assault with a deadly weapon. I mean, luckily she didn't die. Like, luckily she survived that, because that's a lot of trauma to her head, like the rock and then the street. He was placed in the Atascadero State Hospital. I'm probably saying that wrong, but I simply don't know how to say it. He was a mentally disordered sex offender. That was the category that he was put under in the hospital. And he was released after 5 years because they deemed that he was no further threat to others.
Okay.
Incorrect, obviously. So 3 months later, he strangled a woman until she became unconscious and then raped her. And after a month after the assault, he was identified as the rapist and was convicted of forcible rape. So while serving this sentence at the San Luis Obispo prison is when he met Lawrence Bittaker, who was there for his attempted murder of over steak, which is still odd to me. Like, how do you have that high of an IQ, but your idea of how to steal a steak is stuffing it down your pants? Anyways, that's besides the point. So Norris claims that Bittaker saved his life in the prison twice, and that's kind of how they got close. They then bonded over their sadistic fantasies. They basically discovered that they both had the same fantasies of what they would like to do to women. So that's how they created their bond with each other. And while they were in prison, they developed a plan to rape and torture women together and to kill them so that they could ensure that they wouldn't be caught. Because somehow the reason that Norris got caught was because the woman that he assaulted, he didn't kill. Which is just not how it works, but whatever. So after being paroled, Bittaker took a job as a machinist in Los Angeles. And Norris was paroled 2 months later and moved in back in with his mother in Los Angeles and became an electrician. He reportedly began an incestuous relationship with his mother at this time.
No.
It's not confirmed, but it's also not denied. So it wouldn't be surprising, considering the fact that when he was 16, he made sexual advances to a relative.
But his mom?
I wouldn't be surprised if that was already happening when he was younger. And that's kind of why he thought it was okay to make advances on a relative. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't be surprised if this was not the first incestuous relationship he was involved in. But again,
moving on.
I don't know.
I can't.
There's nothing to base that off of. That's just something I feel is pretty relevant to include, especially considering what he and Bittaker were doing at the time to women. So in February of 1979, the two of them finally made contact with each other and began to execute their plan, which is where Ella will take over.
Okay. I did not know any of their background because Becky was looking into that. So that was all new information for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris. So from February to June of 1979, Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris picked up girls. They picked up over 20 hitchhikers. They didn't assault any of them. They were practice runs. So they were practicing how to lure girls into the van and finding secluded locations. Late in April, they found an isolated fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker broke open the lock on the gate and replaced it with his own lock. Mm-hmm. Which, this isn't, again, I'm going to sidetrack for 2 seconds. I know this isn't important. Well, it is kind of important. Did no one notice that the lock had been changed on this fire road? Because what happened, what would have happened if there was a fire?
Well.
And they couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. That's just another question. That's not really important, but I just was wondering.
There's a lot of things to question in cases like this. So it makes sense.
So June 24th, 1979, they picked up their first victim, Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. Now, Bittaker, we have written accounts from Bittaker. He wrote down every account of every victim that they took. So he stated in his account that the day started by them finishing the construction of a bed in the back of a van that they had purchased. Under the bed, they placed tools, clothes, and a cooler with beer and soft drinks.
Oh, because that's super important. It's just the details are always so weird and off-putting in cases, you know?
Yeah. By 11 a.m., they drove to the beach area drinking, smoking, and they started flirting with girls. They spent all day there. Around 7:46 p.m., and I'm just going to say again, the reason why we have such specific times and specific details about these cases is because of Bittaker's written accounts.
Can I also say something?
Because of, Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But Ella's saying girls for a reason. Like, a lot of that, they were very, very young. Like, they were not grown women that they were picking up. Like, yeah. I just feel like that's important to say. Like, we're not just referring to women as girls.
Yeah.
They were.
I'll get into that, too. Like,
sorry.
Talking about their ages. But, yeah, so we have a lot of details about these cases because of Bittaker's written accounts, and that's how we know, like, what exactly they were doing each day that they kidnapped these victims and what exactly they did to them and what time it was, which, when convicting them, was very helpful, but it's also, I can't imagine reading all of that. That mm-hmm. must have been just so
especially the victims'
awful.
Families.
Well, I don't think they would have had the victims' family
well,
read
I
all
hope,
of that.
But.
But, yeah. So, 7:46 p.m., Norris spotted Schaefer. She was walking down a side street towards her grandmother's house. Bittaker, in quotes, said, "There's a cute little blonde."
Oh.
And they pulled up next to her and unsuccessfully attempted to entice her into the van. They offered her marijuana, a lift home, and she denied them. They drove a little further up the road and parked. Norris hid behind the passenger door, and when Schaefer passed, they exchanged a few words before Norris dragged her into the van. Bittaker turned the volume up on the radio, and Norris bound her legs and arms and gagged her with duct tape. They drove to the fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker wrote in his accounts that she initially screamed but then regained her composure. He wrote, and I quote, "She displayed a magnificent state of self-control and acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She said she shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. I guess she knew what was coming."
Oh, no.
Which... Again, I can't imagine...
He's projecting.
I can't imagine reading everything that he had written down because that's just so disturbing.
I mean, even just reading that is, like, makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Once they were at the fire road, Norris was the first to rape her, telling Bittaker to return in an hour. When Bittaker returned, he then raped her, and then Norris raped her again. The second time that Norris did this, she asked if they were going to kill her, and Norris said no. Schaefer, assuming that she was going to die, asked for time to pray before they killed her, which they did not let her do. In the accounts of the murder after they were arrested, they both claimed that the other wanted to kill her while the other one wanted to let her go. So Norris said that Bittaker wanted to kill her and he wanted to let her go, but then Bittaker said that Norris wanted to kill her and he wanted to let her go.
He said.
Yeah. So Norris attempted to manually strangle her, but after 45 seconds, he couldn't do it and ran to the front of the van and threw up. So then Bittaker had to finish. He strangled her until she dropped to the ground, and then he tied a coat hanger around her neck and twisted it until she died. Her body was wrapped in a plastic curtain, and they threw it over the canyon. And Bittaker said that the animals would eat her up so there would be no evidence left.
But if they thought the animals were going to eat them, like, why bother with the plastic curtain? You know what I mean? Like, why not just make it, like, I don't know, it just seems weird.
I guess
if that
so,
was your
in
hope.
Case anyone, like, the next day spotted her. I don't know. So then, July 8th, 1979, 2 weeks after their first victim, they killed their first victim. They picked up 18-year-old Andrea Joy Hall. She was hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. They pulled over, and another vehicle pulled over too. They both offered her rides home, and she wound up getting into the other vehicle. Norris and Bittaker followed them mm-hmm. until they dropped her off at the Redondo Beach, where Norris hid in the back of the van so she would think that Bittaker was the only one there. Bittaker offered her a drink. She got into the van, and that's when Norris pounced on her and tied her up and gagged her. They drove to the fire road again, where they both raped her, and they forced her to walk up a hill naked and have sex with them, and they also took pictures of her. This is where they started taking photos of their victims, like very pornographic photos of them. They then drove to another location and made her walk up another hill. At this point, Norris actually left Bittaker with her alone and went to get alcohol. When he returned, he found Bittaker alone with more pictures of Hall. And in these photos, Norris said that she looked terrified, and Bittaker said that she was begging for her life, begging to be spared. And Bittaker said that he told her that he was going to kill her and told her to come up with reasons why she shouldn't be killed, and then he would spare her.
Oh.
He did not spare her life. He killed her. I'm not going to go into details about this one, because if you thought the last one was gruesome, this one is just terrible. So if you want to know, go look it up. Bittaker threw her body off a cliff. September 3rd of the same year, 1979, they picked up Jackie Doris Gilman, who was 15, and Jacqueline Leah Lamp, who was 13.
That's so young.
Yeah. They picked up the girls at a bus stop. The girls accepted the ride, and Bittaker started towards the fire road. When the girls realized that they weren't going in the direction that they wanted to, Lamp tried to get out of the van. Norris hit her over the head and knocked her out. Gilman then tried to fight her way out. Norris overpowered her and tied her up and gagged her. During this, Lamp woke up and tried to escape again. Norris was kind of struggling to get them, like overpower them. So Bittaker actually had to stop and help Norris finish gagging them and tying them up. Now, this one was a little bit different. They held the girls captive for 2 days, actually. They sexually abused them, took photos of them, and Bittaker recorded him raping Gilman. This is the first time that he decided to record that. They tortured Gilman more than they tortured Lamp, assuming because she was older than Lamp, and they... Over the 2 days that they held them captive, they slept with them as well. They did eventually kill them after those 2 days and also threw their bodies off a cliff. Again, if you want more details, go read it on your own time. So then that brings us to their final victim, which is Shirley Lynette Ledford, the case that we discussed in our Halloween episode. This was October 31st of 1979. She was 16 years old. She was abducted from a gas station. As I said, she was their last victim. She was held captive for just 2 hours. They sexually abused her, and Bittaker again taped that, and they took pictures of her. And she was strangled to death. Her body was actually found by a jogger the next morning. They had just left her on the side of the road.
Oh.
So that's kind of what got the investigation rolling, because they didn't throw her body off a cliff.
Like the others, yeah.
Yeah. So then the investigation, November of 1979, Norris became acquainted with a friend, Joseph Jackson, who he had met in prison during one of his stays. Norris told him about what they were doing, and Jackson did not feel comfortable with this, was concerned. So he consulted his attorney. His attorney told him to go tell the authorities, obviously. So he informed the Los Angeles Police Department. They then turned it to the Hermosa Beach Police.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that he did go forward and report that to the police.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also, if he didn't, and then they would have eventually been caught, he could have been arrested for
aiding and abetting.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't think of the word.
So, Detective Paul Bynum, I think is how you pronounce his last name, was assigned to this investigation. They placed Norris under surveillance without his knowledge and caught him dealing marijuana. November 20th of 1979, Norris was arrested by the Hermosa Police Department for parole violation.
Yeah.
That same day, Bittaker was arrested for the rape of Robin Robeck.
Mm-hmm.
Did you talk about her?
No.
Oh, so this was another woman that he had raped before they started murdering these girls?
Oh, I might have talked about her, but I didn't have her name.
Okay, so yeah, she was another woman that Bittaker had raped, did not kill before these murders took place. I'm not sure if that was after he was released from jail or if that was
that could have been the one that
on in his life.
That could have been the one that, oh wait, Bittaker?
Yeah, Bittaker.
But no, I did not talk about it. Oh. I only talked about Norris's.
Well, at some point, Bittaker had raped Robin Robeck and was never held accountable for it. So he was arrested for the rape of Robin Robeck. Once placed under arrest, Robeck could not identify Bittaker in a police lineup, but they both, Norris and Bittaker, were held on parole violations.
Mm-hmm.
A search of Bittaker's apartment, police found pictures of the missing girls, they found tools and necklaces of the victims, as well as the recordings.
Mm-hmm. Lots of trophies.
Mm-hmm. In Norris's apartment, they found pictures. These were pictures of over 500 women at the beach. So I think he also had pictures of their victims, but Norris had pictures of just random girls at the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had bracelets of the victims. So, on November 30th of 1979, Norris attended a preliminary hearing. At first, he denied any involvement in the murders, rapes, and disappearances. But once confronted with the evidence, he began to confess. While confessing, he tried to portray Bittaker as the one who was more involved in it, the mastermind, the brains of the operation, however you want to say it. And he agreed to return to the San Gabriel Mountains to help search for the bodies.
Oh.
Now, Schaefer and Hall's bodies were never found. On February 9th, 1980, Lamp and Gillum's bodies were found. So, yeah, two of the girls' bodies were found. The two that were abducted together, Lamp and Gillum, their bodies were found, but Schaefer and Hall's bodies were never found.
That's awful for their families.
I know. February 1980, Norris and Bittaker were formally charged with the murders of the five girls. Bittaker was denied bail, but Norris was granted bail, and it was set at $10,000. Just $10,000.
Hello? Why?
So, Norris agreed that he would testify against Bittaker if they wouldn't seek the death penalty for him. So, on March 18th, 1980, Norris pled guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second. 2 counts of rape, 1 count of robbery. And again, he was testifying against Bittaker, so he could avoid the death penalty and to avoid life without parole, which I think is insane.
I also think, was it really necessary for them to do that? And like, because of the recordings and all the detail that Bittaker had taken, did they really need his testimony to like convict him? Like, they could have not done that and gotten them both harsher sentences. Like, I don't know. I feel like they had enough without that.
I agree.
That sits weird with me.
So May 7th of 1980, Norris was sentenced to 45 years to life, and he would be eligible for parole starting in 2010. April 24th of 1980, Bittaker was arraigned on 29 charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, murder, criminal conspiracy, possession of a firearm, and conspiracy to commit murder. Bittaker, when asked if he had done all of this or like to plead guilty or not guilty, he refused to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
So January 19th, 1981, Bittaker's trial began. Bittaker testified for himself.
Mm.
And
good character witness right there.
Yeah. And again, Norris testified against Bittaker at his trial.
Yeah.
So then March 24th, Bittaker was formally sentenced to death. And if it was ever changed to life, the judge said it would immediately switch to a sentence of 199 years and 4 months.
So specific.
He did try to appeal this, but he obviously did not get that.
How did he think he was going to? Like, be so serious.
Yeah. His execution was set for July 23rd of 1991, which he also tried to appeal. And he was granted a further stay. And he, basically every time his execution date was set again, he would appeal it. He would appeal everything. And he never showed any remorse, which is the most, it just angers me every case.
I mean, he was a sociopath.
Every case we talk about, it angers me. He said that he was only upset for being caught and ruining his own life.
I mean, again, he was a sociopath, so that, like, makes sense that he would feel that way in the sense that he was a sociopath and he didn't care about anyone else. But it's just so impossible to understand.
Yeah. So he also filed over 40 lawsuits against the whole trial.
Oh my God, just let it go.
Like, anything and everything that he could file a lawsuit against or appeal, he would.
He was smart. Like, there was no way he thought that that was going to, like, actually work.
Yeah. He died on December 13th of 2019 at age 79, just of natural causes. So Norris, as I said, was first eligible for parole in 2010. It actually wound up being 2009 that he was eligible, but he refused to go to his parole hearing. So then his parole eligibility was set back another 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So then in 2019, he did go to his parole hearing and was denied.
Good.
And then he died the following year.
Also good.
In 2020. I am not sure how old he was. Apparently, I didn't write that down.
Well, he was 8 years younger than Bittaker.
Oh, so he was 71.
They died the same year?
Oh, no. So he was 72.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, around 72. There are a lot of portrayals of this case, I will call it. There was a documentary film made in 2012 called The Devil and the Death Penalty. There's been many books about this case. There's been many TV series about this case. We'll link as many as we can on our Instagram. But yeah, that is the Toolbox Killer's case.
Yeah. I mean, it's like we said, it's a very, very vulgar, disgusting
case. I left a lot of details about what they actually did to these girls out because, again, I did not feel comfortable saying that.
And it's
I
don't
think it's necessary to say.
Not with the goal that we have with this podcast to get victims' names out there. It wasn't. It's not necessary.
Yeah. And then I also, there's a lot of details about how their trials went. Like I said, Bittaker was just difficult through the entire thing, never showed remorse. Just disgusting.
But there's a lot out there that you guys can look into at your own time that we'll post links to, as well as the articles that we use to do our research. But again, we couldn't say anything for a lot of reasons, one of them including time, because it's just such a complicated case. And because of the amount of detail that is known because of Lawrence Bittaker, it's just too much.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Follow us on Instagram.
At behind_the_crime.
And on Facebook.
Just Behind the Crime. And check out our website, which is in the links in the bio, our bios on both Instagram and Facebook. We have a lot of information up there and links to all the episodes, as well as the graphics that we make that go with them and their episode descriptions. We will see you in 2 weeks, which will also be the first week of our spring semester.
Yeah, so we are pre-recording these episodes, if we didn't say that in this one.
Yeah, probably so know already. This will come out in the end of January, and we're recording it in the beginning of December. Oh, wow, I forgot it was December.
Yeah, so did I. Almost said November.
So did I.
It's the 3rd
of November. It feels like November. It is the 3rd. Let us know what you thought about this episode. There's always a poll at the end of all of these, at least on Spotify. So make sure to fill that out. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.